Good morning, good morning. Thank you for having me back again, you crazy, crazy people. I'd like to talk today a little bit about challenging your thinking, and as I was thinking and preparing for the presentation and realized that I've been chosen by the Committee on Academic Libraries, I thought I'd start there. All too often, we define our profession, and particularly our role with our profession, as a sort of cold and objective profession. We deal with truth objectively, calmly, scholarly. I chose this image. This is Gross's surgeon during the Civil War, a doctor in the Philadelphia area, and here he is giving a lecture by actually doing surgery. And what I love about this picture is that here are all these fine, refined gentlemen sitting in their coats and ties with scalpels tearing open someone's leg. And of course, we have to have the obligatory shying away woman in the side. There you go. But this is the image of a professor, right? The image of a professor who stands above the mess and above the fray and brings a cold sense of logic and objectivity to it. And I think all too often when we look at the library profession, we have these same images, that somehow we are a profession, particularly in the academic setting, that is scholarly, that is above the fray, that is one that pursues and seeks truth. But and the sort of symbol of this being the professor. And as a professor, I can tell you that I'm anything but objective. And I actually look at the origin of the word, which is to profess. Here's from the Oxford English Dictionary, right? A professor is one who teaches, but I like the second one, a person who affirms a faith or allegiance in something. What we have to understand is that we declare that in the scholarly world, in the academic world, truth, knowledge, understanding, seeking to understand the world is anything but a cold and objective and passionless endeavor. In fact, quite the opposite. When we talk about the idea of discovery, we talk about epiphanies and revelations. When we seek out truth and knowledge, this is a passionate endeavor. This is an endeavor of heat, of debate, of argument. That when you look at the best of what we do, it is to inspire. And inspiring is never done with someone who is cold and objective. I teach a doctoral seminar, and one of the first lessons I do with the doctoral students is that I try and whack them on the head, because we spend a good amount of time with doctoral students teaching them about tools and methodologies and validity and reliability and generalizability and research methods and right? And I say, so what's your question? And they always have rather timid questions, because after the years of going through the process, every time they came up with a wild, crazy question, there was always someone to say, well, how would you prove that? How would you measure that? How would you understand that? And so one of the exercises I do is I say, take a profession that you're interested in. Take an area, an industry, what have you, and analyze and understand where it is. Look at the literature, look at the methods, look at the findings. And then predict where it's going, because obviously what we're into is theory and prediction, so find out where that point is along the chain. I say, now, this is what you have read. This is what you have understood to be a scholarly pursuit. I said, however, it's not true. It is insufficient. For example, if I were to ask you, what is the future of libraries? There are many people who would look at that, analyze it, study it, and say, oh, the future of libraries is nothing. That we're going to go away, we're going to be obsolete, right? Slate, all this wonderful stuff. And I have to ask then, are you satisfied with that answer? Because if you're not satisfied with that answer, then don't you have an obligation to do something about it, to be an activist in that pursuit? And in fact, that's what I teach the doctoral students, is I say, all right, you've got where we are, you've got your predicted future, but you need to have an ideal future. And in fact, that gap that between the ideal future and your predicted future is your research agenda. It is where your questions come from. It is ultimately what we are in the business of doing, to have an ideal future and see where it's going. And this is not passionless and cold. Science, scholarship, academia is a passionate field approached with dispassionate tools. Right? The reason we have validity and generalizability and reliability and all these methodologies is to allow the truth to emerge, but the question begins with a passion, with an understanding. So, given that, I think what we really need to do is spend some time, because it's also a data question, right? Imagine, for example, that you were the customer survey person on the deck of the Titanic. And as you're sinking slowly into the cold North Atlantic and Leonardo DiCaprio is running the other way, you're sitting there with your clipboard asking people what they thought of their experience. And by the end of it, you can say, we're pretty sure people didn't like the iceberg. But it may be valid and reliable data that doesn't matter. Right? What we do all too often is we go and worry so much about the content of the data that we forget that the question is important. How many people have done the infamous library satisfaction survey where you sit down and your first question is, what do you think of the library? And what we know is the answer, right? If we ask them in the library, the answer, it's great. It's fine. It should be open longer. But, you know, this, right? If they're outside the library, they're like, the what? Oh, my favorite is from Ann Arbor District Library, Eli Nyberger. They post all their comments on their website, and his one, I may be getting this wrong, but I think I've got the gist of it. Love the library, need more porn and pie. You know? What do you do with that comment? I mean, one, you could, in fact, give them more porn and pie and drive up your statistics, but on the other hand, that may not be where you want to go with this. Right? What we have to realize is in our pursuit and in our direction, we must recapture the fact that we shape our future. And so what we need and what we're going to do today, we need a library revival meeting. Now, I came equipped. I will not be handling snakes today. However, if anyone feels like a gospel tune is up, feel free to come here. Right? I don't care if you're a Jew or a Gentile, a Muslim or a Hindu. I don't care if you're an atheist or an agnostic. But the point is, we need to find the passion in what we do. We need to find the excitement of what we do. And we need, as a profession, to become a chorus of people calling out for change and making the world better. Because all too often, we look at the library and we assume that it's some abstract entity. I just saw a pronouncement about what the future of the library was. The library is eternal and its mission never changes, and the librarians are there to basically service it. No. The library is a bunch of bricks and mortar and documents and web pages and whatever. You are the library. You are the value that we bring to it. Right? This is ultimately what we need to talk about. And so, if I am, in fact, the preacher, you folks are the choir today. And it may seem odd to people, it may seem unusual, maybe even uncomfortable to use a religious metaphor in this point, but if you think about it, library science has plenty of religious background, right? For example, we have our commandments. Right? That's how we, they're laws, for God's sake. I mean, I don't know who passed them, but they're laws. Now, actually, if you look at this for a moment, sometimes we read these as if they are etched in stone, and we forget that Ranganathan said there at number 5, which is the library is a growing organism, which means it's changing. If Ranganathan had been around in the Greek era, in the Hellenic era, he probably would have talked about scrolls are for use. Scrolls, every reader at scroll, etc., right? The idea that it's about books is irrelevant to Ranganathan, it's just that was the technology at the time. Right? Now, not only do we have our commandments, we have our prophets. This is, honest to God, a picture of Melville Dewey. Painted in a mural in Lake Placid, Florida, where after he left upstate New York, he went down to Florida to recreate his utopian society. And if you think about it a minute, right, this is how we name dogs after Dewey, for God's sake, right? We name our fish after Dewey. We treat him as if he's, I mean, some people have basically, you know, the little symbol up to him in different places. We treat Dewey in a different way, even though he doesn't necessarily deserve it all the time. And, you know, think about the religious overtones. Where did Dewey come up with the Dewey Decimal System? Anyone know the story? During a long sermon in church. I mean, you know,
Melville. Think decimals.
Yes. Right? This is the idea that we have. He had an epiphany. He had an epiphany, he had a passion, he came from an evangelical period in upstate New York, and he went forth and he preached the word. Not only that, we have our holy books. Right? Right? And our high priestess of the holy books. right, that talks about how we, what we are to do and how we are to proceed. Not only that, but some of you, I have to show my Jesuit education, there's a difference between your faith and what's called dogma. Dogma is, in fact, the rules by which you are supposed to pursue it, but it's a human endeavor. But we have our dogma. And thank goodness, ALA gave us beautiful dogma. And by that, I mean piece of junk dogma. If you want to get me started on this, I could go the rest of the day on why these don't work. But let me just give you my little insight, which is if you read these documents, it's a laundry list. Thou shalt know history. Thou shalt know service. Thou shalt know classification. Thou shalt know philosophy. Thou shalt know research. That's why. Thou shalt know. Why. Thou shalt know. Why. That. Why that, not that. There's no connective tissue between that document. That document talks about a set of things you have to know, not why or how they're connected. Right? I think all too often when we hear cries for reform LIS education, what we end up hearing is this course and this course and this course and not curriculum and approaches and missions and what's that ideal future that we're working towards. Now, there's a thing about dogma. Dogma is a social contract. It means that people come together, whether it's between the profession and LIS education, the community and its agency, whatever it is, people come together and come up with an agreement, sometimes implicit, sometimes in the case of things like library charters, very explicit, that says, this is what we expect of you. And what we have to understand in terms of coming up with that compact is it's not just us. It's allied profession, the people who fund us, and all this other thing. The other thing we have to understand about dogma is that dogma evolves over time. Dogma is not a static thing. Now, some of you may or may not know this type of document, but this is a legal document. It's a medieval law text. And if you look at that red N in the middle two columns, that's the actual law. That's the legal thing being discussed. And all the text around the outside is what's called a gloss. It's where scholars have gone in and basically done notes in the margins. And after generation and generation and generation, they eventually became formalized a part of the text. Now, keeping with our religious theme and the fact that we're in the temple room, this is actually even a more beautiful example. This is the Babylonian Talmud. Now, the Talmud is a remarkable document. It talks about dogma. It talks about Jewish law. And what they've done with the Talmud is you can see the columns going around. Each one of them can be color-coded to different scholars talking about the rabbinic traditions that go along with this law. And so this idea of annotation document, you know, eventually things get complex. And if you look around our profession, our dogma, our basic instructional text, our information that we're supposed to know has become encrusted with these annotations and thoughts. Right? Now, whatever we do is going to turn into a committee. Whatever we do on a large scale is going to turn into a standard. Whatever we do is going to turn into a best. What we have been doing is we have increasingly encrusted the tradition and mission and thoughts of the library with more and more policy, regulation, and anticipation of consequences. I talked to many a library director, and I asked them, first of all, what do they need out of graduates from library science school? Their number one answer, by the way, is common sense. And I said, if I could teach that, my wife would be thrilled, because I could do stay-at-home courses. We need customer service and problem-solving. You know what they never answer? We need a really good AACR2 expert who can understand the SIP standard coming out of NISO and such. So that may be useful stuff. But the point is, what are we doing that for? I was part of a standard. Back in the virtual reference days, we went to NISO, and the idea was, if you've lived through this, right, so you have question point, and no, someone else over there has their own homegrown system, and someone else over there has tutor.com and such, and we wanted to be able to do something really radical, like move questions back and forth through the system. Right? And so we sat down and we said, how do we do this? And they said, oh, we need a standard. Okay, so we all showed up at the Library of Congress, a bunch of us, and we said, okay, we need a way to move this question from here to here. And within milliseconds, we were talking about things like RPC agendas and how we could do it like Z39.50, because that was such a successful implementation. And so what we began to do was encrust it. We took like 500 years of tradition and wrapped it around a new problem and said, that solved it. How many people have been at the third meeting. I always talk about this as the revenge of the librarian meeting. Right? The revenge of the librarian meeting goes something like this. The first meeting, two organizations get together. Two units on campus, two associations within a community, whatever it is. And they all say, hey, let's work together. We should share our stuff. Great. Second meeting. Hey, we want to go share our stuff, and we realize that we call things different things. You call it artist, we call it author. You call it creator, you call it whatever. Isn't there someone who could figure out this problem? And so the third meeting, we get invited, which is really cool. And I used to think of this as a sign of success until I realized what would happen. And by the way, I'm terribly guilty with this, which is we would show up at the third meeting, and what we would do is we would bring our box of hammers. Now, you know the old joke about a hammer? To a hammer, everything's a nail, regardless of the problem. That's what we do. So we look at these people and go, boy, you guys are so smart. You're right. You need to call them the same thing. So therefore, deep breath, you need a taxonomy. And a taxonomy, we could use an ontology and a mesh system. But really what we have to do is dereference the anything so we can create a classification scheme. The classification scheme really needs to have a one-to-one relationship. And if we take the classification scheme, we can then put it into the standard. Then we can create a thesaurus. The thesaurus we can put online into a repository. So then we're done with, blah, blah, blah. And the people would just sit there and go like this. And we would feel really impressed with ourselves until we realized that at the fourth meeting, we were the only ones that showed up. Right? What we did over and over again is we looked at these 100 years of traditions and we assumed that they were, in essence, ready for them. We assumed that they were ready for this idea, and it's not true. People, to develop a thesaurus, to develop a taxonomy, is to develop a language. Languages take centuries to evolve, unless you're Dewey and it comes to you in a dream during a long sermon. But it really is also, what we need to be doing in the meeting 3, 4, 5, 6 is facilitating them trusting each other. That they can be agreeable and not lose their own unique identity in this. That's something that we learned. If you think about it, we bring this box of hammers and we leave behind the really valuable stuff, which is, libraries are brilliant at building consortiums, building shared resources, and working together. We have processes in there, and we need to make them more open. I was at several meetings where I said, you know, it's interesting, the VRD meetings, VRD conferences. The first conference was about half librarians, half people in the ASCA world, people like ASCA volcanologists and ASCA biologists and help desks. By the third meeting, there was no one but librarians, and I was commenting this, and someone at OCLC said, you know, this isn't the first group where librarians have driven everyone else off. Right? We think that, for example, the thing we like to ping on is that the technologists like to intimidate us. You know, I mean, the old joke is that technologists never say no. Can we put this online? They'll never just say no or don't wanna. What they'll do is they'll start throwing acronyms at us till we give up. Right? Well, we could put it online, but then it has to go through our firewall. And if it goes through the firewall, we're using DHCP lookup. And if we let DHCP, then we have the MySQL and search, right? They're saying no. We do the same damn thing. Right? That classification, Dublin Core, XML, double dereference, tokenized, blah, 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 blah. That's our way of saying no in some ways. Well, we can't do it, but no. So what we need is to look at this trust. What we need is what happened in the church. What we need is someone to nail some theses onto a bar. And what's interesting, by the way, this is Martin Luther, so we can talk about the Catholic Church, but just about every other major religion in the world has gone through the same thing, where they realize that their dogma has become so overly concerned with rules and values and how we're to behave that they forgot what they're here to do in the beginning. It's lost our way, and we need to look at reformation in our own little cult. We must return to our roots. We must see past the old debates of L versus I, books versus digital, all this other stuff. We must move past the idea that we have this dogma and look back to our true and original mission. And there are people who, in essence, we have to do what? Picking the religious thing, what Paul said in Thessalonians, which is test everything and retain what is good. Right? We need to test everything we do on a regular basis and see if we need it. We need to be analytical about this. I don't know if you guys do this, but I've been at many conferences where speakers get up and they almost always start with the year of their degree. But it's never done as the year of their degree. It's always started out, well, when I got my library degree, when dinosaurs roamed, or in the ancient times, or when we had stone tablets. Right? Who cares when you got your degree? What are you doing now? What are we doing now to look at this, and what's our mission? Now, some people will look to history and say, and I agree, we should look to history. Why are we here? Not only what do we need to do now, right? The whole Web 2.0 thing. If you read the Web 2.0 literature, there's two things you find in there. One is some brilliant ideas about community and creativity. The other thing you'll find, a healthy dose of venom for the past. You will find a lot of people that will say, throw the catalog away. Why? Because it came before. Right? Throw this away. Throw all our ideas away because they've come before. Now, I think, by the way, we should throw away the catalog, and I'd be glad to talk about why. But we need to understand what we did right to continue that. Our history is important. I want to be really clear. When I'm talking about Reformation, when I'm talking about the mission, when I'm talking about moving forward, it does not invalidate what you have done before. It does not invalidate when you got your degree in the dinosaur age. It does not invalidate what happened up to this point. But what it does is recognize that the reason we are here today is because people made conscious decisions to change. Brother Nathan wasn't just encoding stuff that he found on the street or that he learned out of a textbook. Dewey wasn't just applying something he figured out from someone else. These were people who looked to innovate the field. So, yes, we need to understand our history, understand our tradition, but also we must be able to interpret it, and that means we need to understand our worldview. Let me tell you what I mean. Here's one history of library view. And it starts with the Library of Alexandria, right? We always start with the Library of Alexandria. Right? We were probably, the joke is that we're the second oldest profession, right? When the first one needed to organize their clients, you know, we were there. I could make a joke about organizing by size, but we're not going to. So, we're all adults. So, the idea here is that we had the Library of Alexandria. The Library of Alexandria was bringing all the stuff from the world together and putting it in one place. My favorite aspect of the Library of Alexandria is when the ships would come into the port of Alexandria, which was a major trading post, they would send soldiers down to the ship and confiscate all the documents on the boat. They would take these to the library, and the library would produce copies. They gave the copies back to the boat. I think this is brilliant. We should have people set up at the border. Anyone coming into Connecticut, we should download. Anyway, so we had this great collection, and then, of course, through some mysterious circumstance, and it kind of depends on whether you're anti-Islamic, anti-Semitic, anti-Christian, anti-someone as to who did it, but someone burned down the Library of Alexandria. We entered into a dark age, not directly causal, but for some librarians, I think they believe it to be. And what happened was information ended up in scriptoriums, and the monks copied information back and forth, and that therefore preserved it. That led to a Renaissance, and then we move ahead, and we end up with the idea of libraries becoming for the people, and so we give that credit to Benjamin Franklin in Philadelphia, who opened up the library and made it available to everyone, which became the modern blueprint for the public library in America that spread out to the rest of the world. Now, it's a convincing and interesting dialogue. It's a narrative of history, and one you probably have heard before in some form. But I want to give you an alternative narrative to talk about how worldview influences this. And I'm going to start at the Library of Alexandria as well, but you need to understand that when we talk about the Library of Alexandria, it is not a library as we would traditionally think about it. It was a campus. It was much more like a university than it was a library. And in fact, all the scrolls and documents that they were confiscating didn't go in the library. It went in the musée, which was a building built and dedicated to the muses for inspiration. The library was a separate building that was more or less a dormitory and community space for scholars around the ancient world. And what happened was one of the first economic development plans of its time, Alexandria would invite and fund and give tax breaks to scholars from around the known ancient world to come and think and talk. And when they came up with brilliant ideas and wrote them down, they left the library and they went in to the musée, which is where we get the word museum. Because at that point, it was for inspiration, not the knowledge itself. And what's interesting is while you look at it, the collection of that didn't actually disappear. In many ways, it ended up over in the Islamic world. And in fact, this is a library from Toledo, Spain. And during the Crusades, when the Pope was a little worried that all his noblemen were walking around and hitting each other and decided to get them out of Europe, he said, go free someone. Let's go with Spain. And so what happens is all the Crusaders showed up at Toledo, which was pretty hilarious because most of them were Islamic and half of them were intermarried with the people in Toledo. And the people in Toledo said, hey, come on in. And what they found at that point were library after library after library. And this library, for example, had more volumes in this one library of 80 in Toledo alone than all the books in France at the same time. And another amazing thing happened, where these folks, where the monks were sitting copying manuscripts, which they couldn't read in many cases, it was an act of prayer, these folks were reading the information and using it to revolutionize architecture and water, and had rediscovered and kept all the information from Aristotle and all the information. And what happened then was they sent translators after translators down to Toledo to translate these texts, where they discovered little radical things like zero and algebra and these things, and a lot of text on law. And so a lot of that, remember that law document I found was initially a translation out of this library that went in, and all the noblemen who were worried about how to handle their peasants started wanting to learn the legal documents. And so what they got to do is they gathered together in places and they began to hire tutors in. And eventually they built buildings for them. And this was the origin of the modern university. And in fact, up until the late 1900s, my salary as a professor would have been paid by the students directly instead of from the university. Until we realized there's a little conflict of interest there. Right? Which we've gotten back to with great inflation. But anyway, the point being, this information went up. And this idea that Benjamin Franklin invented the public library is wrong. He invented a subscription library. Benjamin Franklin built the first library in Philadelphia, but it was a place where he collected his text, and his other buddies would put their text, and they charged a usage fee. The original public library in Philadelphia is actually from this man, who I swear to God's name is Dr. Pepper. Dr. Pepper had a rich uncle. He was a professor at Pennsylvania University of Pennsylvania, and he said, there is an important need for us to share this information and improve our society. Let's get together a fund. And they built the true first public university in Philadelphia that was free for the public to use, and he did it as a social good. Now, my point with this is your worldview, this mission view, if you believe that your mission as a librarian is to organize material and deal with recorded knowledge, which we'll get to in a moment, this makes sense. If, on the other hand, you look at the library's mission very differently, this doesn't make sense at all. Which is, what we see here is a move from the idea of collection to a move of scholarship. This is a vision where the value of the Library of Alexandria was in its stuff, this was in its production. We see a shift from dissemination to action. The value of the scriptoriums and the monks was in making the copies so we didn't lose the information. Here, the value of the library was that we built things from it. We understood geometry. And here, we see that the value is in sharing, putting it all together, but there, the value is social good, putting it to work. Right? So what we really see here is a shift in knowledge as thing versus knowledge is action. And so let me just take that for a moment and talk about this phrase, recorded knowledge. It's all through that core competencies document, and I hate this term most of all, Scarecrow. Right? Recorded knowledge to me is like intelligent stone. It's an oxymoronic statement. It doesn't make it. This is a rock, just in case you were wondering. Now, what's interesting about this rock is when you look at it, you might say, it's a rock, right? This rock actually sits on the porch, the veranda, of White's Taliesin West, Frank Lloyd Wright's Taliesin West outside of Phoenix. And if you look at it, it actually has ideograms on it. It has Native American iconography. Now, I look at this, I see a rock with some scratches on it. But if you're an archaeologist, you see this as an historical artifact. If you're a geologist, you could probably find out what kind of rock it was and how it was formed in the process. In essence, you can read this rock. But the ability to read the rock is not in the rock. It's in the person who reads it. So recorded knowledge makes no sense because there's no one, in essence, interpreting that. The book on the shelf is not knowledge. The person reading the book is doing knowledge, is having a conversation, not with the author, by the way, but with themselves. How do I understand this? Do I believe this? If you're sitting there going, this guy's full of crap, who are you talking to? this morning, if you woke up and said, I really feel like, you know, these pants make me look fat, who are you talking to? Right? Talking to yourself is okay, by the way, unless you do it out loud in front of the reference desk. Right? So, there is no such thing as recorded knowledge. There is only knowledge. So when you talk about the mission of the library as to organize recorded knowledge, what you're saying is the mission of the library is to warehouse things. Stuff. The value that we bring to this equation is we got more stuff than other people, and we've seen how well that's worked for us in an internet age. Right? If we define our value in our collections, we say that if I leave, then it's okay. If the collections leave, I'm worthless. What do you call a room full of books? A closet. What do you call an empty room with a librarian? A library. Because if you give us an Ethernet connection or a Wi-Fi connection, we'll get you a collection real damn quick. We can pull it together because we're the value that brings to it. So for me, the mission of librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in their communities. Now, I want you to notice a few things about my mission statement that I'm throwing out for you today. First of all, it is not the mission of the library. A library cannot have a mission. Period. Enough said. Done. It's a building. It's a thing. It's stuff. Well, Dave, it's an organization full of people. Fine. It's the people's mission. The librarian has this mission. That means that it becomes something that's not separate from us or aggrandized from us. It is of us. We must take personal responsibility in our mission and in our goal to educate people. We must take a true understanding where we find out that we are the ones who have value. The next thing we do is we facilitate knowledge creation, not knowledge organization, not knowledge finding, not access. We'll get there in a moment. But knowledge creation. When someone comes in and we get them to a resource, didn't we do that so that the book feels like it's got company? When someone comes in and we have instructional design, is it so that our computers were at least being used? And when someone comes in and we buy materials, do we do it because, God, now we don't have those empty shelves? Right? Are we doing interior decorating? No, we're doing it because we're trying to improve someone's life. We're doing it to make someone's life better, to make our organization more important, and therefore it's a human activity, human-to-human activity, and it is ultimately your individual mission that must be aggregated together. Now, let me break down a few of these words. Let's start with what I mean by knowledge. If it's not the things and it's not the stuff and it's not the books, then what is it? And to explain that, I'm going to start with Bob. Here's Bob. Now, Bob has a question, as designated by that hole in Bob's head. Right? Where does that question, where does that need? I call Bob after Bob Taylor, who unfortunately recently passed away and wrote the best article in our field ever done, enough said, which was Question Negotiation in 1968. And in that, Bob talked about an unstated need, which sometimes we know things, but we have no idea how to express that. Right? And we have a reference process that tries to elicit it from them. Right? But we have an unstated need. Where does that need come from? Well, it comes from what Bob already knew. But it also comes from some sort of motivation, which is there are lots of things that we don't know that we really don't care if we know or not. So we've got to have not just this gap, but we've got to have some pressure to fill it. Now, that can either come from an intrinsic source, intrinsic motivation, meaning I have personal desire to know it, or an extrinsic source, meaning someone wants me to know it. And in academic libraries, we deal with all of them. Right? We have people who come in and they just want stuff because they're interested in it. And we have a hell of a lot of people who come in because they have to. Right? It's the annual English torture assignment. You have all the answers for that assignment that you know is coming, and someone comes up to the reference desk and you just let them twist in the wind for 10 minutes before you just say, all right, this is what you really needed. Right? Because they're learning. Learning. Right? So we have some motivation. What Bob's going to do is, over time, Bob's going to explore this gap, going to figure this out. Now, what's Bob going to do to try and understand? Well, Bob is going to engage in a series of conversations. Those conversations may be with librarians, they may be with friends, they may be with colleagues, but the vast majority of conversations that Bob will engage with will be with himself. Now, this is something called critical thinking, metacognition. It's really a lot of the foundational work that we started instructional librarianship around. Right? And so what's going to happen as a result of these conversations is that Bob's going to end up having a series of agreements. Now, what's an agreement? Well, an agreement is, first of all, a statement of belief. 2 plus 2 equals 4. 3 plus 3 equals 6. It's hot out today. I think that the Republicans are wrong. I think the Democrats are wrong. Whatever it is. Something that you hold as a truth to you. Now, that agreement may have some relation to an artifact, meaning where I read it, and it may have some relation to another conversant, who I was talking with when I found it. Dave said, right? Dave said, right? But we also know that over time, those things will disappear. It's called source amnesia. I love the fact that we live in a world full of sources, and we have to realize that by nature, people forget where they learned something. This is why things like rumors and lies are so insidious, is because if you hear something over and over again, you eventually forget the context in which you heard it, but you remember what they said. So this is how rumors start, for example. If we said, did you know that Dave's taking a job? We'll start a rumor today. Dave Lankus is going to take a job in California, right? Now, I just said that. You heard it. It's not true. But here's the thing. If you hear it over and over again, David Lankus is taking a job in California. Dave Lankus is taking... Eventually, you will think, oh, Dave Lankus is taking a job in California. We're getting it. He said, oh, that was an example he gave in a presentation. Right? This is like during the last election cycle. Barack Obama is a Muslim and all this other stuff came out. People heard it over and over again. And they forget the source. Now, the point is that what we're left with is this network of agreements. Now, let you notice a couple things about that. The first is they are related together. When we think about the world, when we understand the world, we approach the world in an interconnected web of agreements. We predict, we anticipate what's going to happen, right? So the example, I think I did this last year, so I'll do it really quickly. Think of the word light, L-I-G-H-T, light, right? Show of hands, the interactive portion of our revival. Show of hands, how many people thought illumination? All right. How many people thought not heavy? How many people thought set a fire? Good, we don't have any arsonists in the room. Now I'm going to give you another one. OMG. How many people thought Omni Media Group? How many people thought, oh my God, right? Now, why? Because here's the thing. With light, all of those senses, you know, they work. You go, oh, yeah, set a fire. I didn't think about that, but yeah, it makes sense. Or, oh, turn on the light. Sure, or not heavy. Yeah, that works too. But with OMG, you really only have one context in which you encounter it, which is either texting or IM. Right? Some people, when I ask where do they hear it, some people say IM, some people say texting. And it's a very strong particular relationship. You really only have one line between the agreement of OMG and the phrase, oh, my God. Whereas with light, you have thousands and thousands and thousands of lines. Right? It's how humor works, by the way. Our brain takes this web and anticipates the next step, what's coming next. Right? So when you hear things like knock, knock, you know to say, interrupting cow, moo. Alright, now the reason that's supposed to be funny is when you think about it, it's unanticipated. You didn't expect someone to interrupt you because you know the sequence. It's like when someone gives you a phone number and they don't follow the form. 315-4-9-7-8-2-1. Right? What was that? It was a phone number. No, it wasn't. 315-4-9-7-8-2-1. This is what we expect. Your brain builds patterns, and when something interrupts the patterns, you're surprised by it. Now, sometimes it's a pleasant surprise. Sometimes it's a shocking surprise. But it's why my 5-year-old can't tell a joke to save his life, because he doesn't get this, right? Knock, knock, who's there? The chicken. The chicken who? The chicken is a blue guy who ran. It's also, by the way, New York Times had a great piece about a couple weeks ago about why you can't remember a good joke. Because your brain is set to find the next part of a phrase, and a good joke breaks the pattern, and so your brain isn't there to record it. All right. It's also the reason we don't remember the sources of where we found things. So we have this agreement. What that means is when we build systems, when we build things to accommodate them, why do things look like this? This is the reserve system, right, of Syracuse, but before anyone picks on Syracuse, I'd be glad to bring up your reserve system. Right? And it's a list of stuff. It's a list of stuff. Right? Think about your catalogs. It's a list of stuff. Now think for a moment how many people have spent an enormous amount of time trying to do the Google thing to their catalog. right? We want a single search box. And wondering why it doesn't work. It doesn't work as good as Google. It doesn't, right? You put in a term, you don't get out what you'd expect to. Why not? Because when Google does what it does, which is to index the web, it has all these relationships of web pages to work from. A lot of pieces point here, a lot of pieces point from here to here. It has this whole map of relations between web pages. Think about your catalog. The only relationship it has to work with, really, is a classification scheme, LC or Dewey or your own. That's not enough. And it certainly has no weights to it. Meaning that you may have a connection, but you have no idea if it's an important connection, useful connection, right? What if you took something like, radical thought, circulation data, anonymize the hell out of it, and throw it in here so that the most popular bump to the top? Oh, Dave, that would be horrible. It would wipe all the good stuff onto page 58. Turns out it's not true. You end up with a power distribution where you're manipulating maybe the top two or three results out of 10. You could do it. That gives you some relational data. But the problem is, even then, it's not going to look something like this. So this is a project I'm working on called the Atlas of New Librarianship, and what it seeks to do is to say, what is librarianship? Rather than as this series of disconnected activities, the idea is it's a set of relationships. And so, for example, if we pop this up, very much a work in progress, we start with, the mission of the library is to improve society. Okay. And we know that knowledge, Dave says, is created through these conversations. Now, it's interesting, that comes from something called conversation theory, and we talked a little bit about memories. Memory, he calls something called an entailment mesh, and annotations, and what's this insufficiency of tagging? By the way, what's the insufficiency of tagging? Tagging, great idea, but take your favorite anything. Take the phone. Write down 10 terms, and you cannot include iPhone as part of the 10 terms. Leave the iPhone, go to the desk next to you, hand them your 10 terms, and see if they can find out what you were describing. Better yet, take that 10 terms, put it at the bottom of your shelf, check it in 6 months, and figure out if you can see what you were describing. Now, turns out that if you aggregate this stuff over time, it gets a social value, and there's a reason for that. But this notion of the way we solve the catalog problem is we throw tagging into it. If we don't understand what tagging does and how it works and how it's connected to memory and how it's connected to understanding and how it's connected to knowledge, but we simply do it because someone else did tagging, doesn't work. I mean, and for example, I'm a blogger. I love blogging. I love wikis. You name it, I've probably done it. I tweet, for God's sake. But if you go to a meeting where someone stands up and says, you must blog, your librarian must blog, your very first question better damn well be, why? And there may be a very good answer to that, you should do it. But if you never ask the why question, then you're in trouble, right? There's a lot of really cool stuff that's going on the web, and it's going to be going on not because it's 2.0 and cool. It's going on because people want to converse, talk, and learn. And when they converse and talk and learn, they do it by creating connected series of relationships. Boy, that sounds like Facebook with a social network to me. But that means we're building it based on theory, not based on what the latest new gadget is. All right? So, if we return for a moment back to, by the way, keep going down to services, not invisibility. We'll get into all this wonderful stuff. We move back to, hopefully, this is when the computer stops working. All right. Aha, here we go. Right? So we move back to knowledge being a connected set of conversations, a connected set of relationships. Now, the mission of the library, what do I mean by the word facilitating? By facilitating, I mean that facilitating is lots of different places. First of all, it's not to be invisible and transparent. If you're going to engage a patron in a conversation requires two equal parties. Two equal parties. You cannot talk to a wall. And so if what your goal is to be as unbiased and as transparent as possible, you are not holding up your end of the bargain. Right? My wife sent me this great little cartoon with a woman pointing a gun at her husband going, put down the laptop and keep up your end of the conversation or else. Right? So one means of facilitation is access. We provide access to the conversations, meaning if those conversations are somehow encoded into a book or its artifacts, or online, we provide computer access. In a journal, we provide access to the journal. In a working group, we provide a physical facility for the working group. By the way, why don't we do it online? Just a thought. All right. Or we allow other people to send their information so that other people can access it. 90% of your library science education was in this box. I would guess that 80% or more of your budget is in this box. But this is an insufficient box. It would be like taking a two-year-old, putting them in your stacks, coming back in 2 weeks, and wondering why they can't read. Right? It's not enough to bring them to a conversation. If I'm brought to a conversation about, you know, postmodernism and all this other stuff, and it's in Spanish, I'm out. I have access to it, but I didn't deal with it. So the next thing we need is knowledge. And we do this pretty well. We do this, we call it library instruction, we call this background. But how many people, for example, have been on the committee, and the committee has literally been in existence in one form or another for 100 years? Right? And how many times have you brought up your brand new cool idea to have someone, the historian of the group, say, oh, what you have to realize is that we tried wikis 50 years ago, and they didn't work. 50 years ago, wikis, really? 1959, you were doing wikis. We had a pencil with an eraser and paper. We left it out on a table, and people could erase the parts they didn't like and write their own in. And you go, wait a minute. And so what's happening is, wouldn't you love to know the last 100 years of decisions? I was organizing the Elise paper panel this year. I know that sounds exciting to everyone, including me. And we had this radical idea. People were going to send us papers, and we were going to take the papers, stick with me, put them online. That was literally the extent of the idea. I took credit for it, too. Until I found out that the board of Elise 4 years ago had passed a resolution that they would not produce an online proceeding. They had preemptively been Luddites. I can't understand that myself, but it would have been nice to know that before I told everyone we were going to put them online. Right? So history is important. An environment of safety. Now, safety can mean, in public safety might mean physical safety. In academic settings, we tend to worry about intellectual safety, that you're able to pursue a topic without being looked over your shoulder or discredited. But even if you take that committee example where you have all the bright ideas and the historian keeps shooting you down, they are not providing a safe environment for you to do that in, and eventually they will shut you out of the conversation. What environment? Physical environment. Reference desks that are this high. Why? To protect us from the feral crowds that will come into us. What does this kind of desk say to people? It says, I'm in charge. Think about reference as a model. What do we do with reference? First of all, you have to come to our space, you show up at my desk where I'm in charge, and admit you don't know something. Is it any wonder that when the students get up the courage, they are disappointed when we don't know the answer and we send them to a book? Right? If I go to all this effort, this person better be brilliant on my problem. Right? Now imagine instead someone walks into a library with a reference question and we hand them a desk. Sit down on the desk, big open desk. And what they begin doing is they ask you a question of resources, they lay them out on the desk. And they begin arranging them in piles. Well, these things are related, these things aren't related. They have index cards where they can put ideas and start drawing lines back and forth because we want to do this all digitally, back and forth. And they can begin to invite people into their desk. Their friends, their colleagues, people passing by, a librarian. And as a librarian, when you walk up to the desk, you can instantly, you don't have to start with, what are you looking for? You can see it. And you can begin manipulating and organizing. Looking at reference as a social activity. And lastly, motivation. Why are people asking this question? Now, we assume that when someone walks into our space, they are motivated. In one form or another, that's not our job. And yet we wonder why people don't come in. What is the motivation? Why? How can we tap into it? A great example from a law library. A law librarian was sitting in her desk, and a lawyer popped head into the law librarian and said, I've got a deposition in 30 minutes. I have an expert witness. I've been searching all night, and I can't find the papers of this expert witness. Librarian, here you go. Right? Took the librarian 20 seconds. The librarian realized what was going on. And so rather than talking about, well, you know, we could do that, come to us, wait for us, what the librarian did was they offered a course in Character Assassination 101, which was the vast majority of the lawyers they were dealing with, they had expert witness testimony. And the deal is when an expert witness goes against you, you want to know everything they've ever done so you can get them in the contradiction. Well, when you were 13, you said that banana seats were the best kind of bicycles, right? They want to be able to do that. And so rather than saying, come to the library, the library's got lots of resources, they said, we're going to tear down the expert witnesses, because they understood the motivation of the lawyers being inherently evil was to do that. Right? So how do we match the motivation? So, and what do I mean by improve society? Because frankly, I look at this mission, and if you want to shorten it to the mission of a librarian is to improve society, I'm perfectly fine with that. Because ultimately, that gets us back to where we started. Which is our profession is not one that needs to sit back and record. I once talked about libraries are like having a shovel in one hand and a catcher's mitt in the other. When someone asks us a question, we shovel resources at them. You see the overzealous librarians chasing patrons out of a building, still throwing more resources at them, right? And they get back to their office like, phew, I missed them, and the phone rings. And it's like, you know, fatal attraction librarian. He killed my buddy. He killed my buddy. All right. But the idea here is, I don't even know where I was going with that. Thank you. The catcher's mitt is then the scholar goes and does their research and conducts their things and whatever, and they write the paper, they send it off for free to Elsevier, and Elsevier then charges his own leg so we can catch the synthesized thing at the end. Right? So we're at the beginning and we're at the end when all the fun stuff is right in the middle. Right? What can we do to facilitate this process? And I ultimately say that libraries must be agents of change. Librarians must be agents of change. We can no longer hide behind our collections. We can no longer say, that's the value. We must stand up front. Now, I once said something to this effect, and someone said, well, if you get this sort of, you know, doesn't that open you up to questions of liability? Doesn't that open you up to questions? Yes. Doesn't that open up your questions of evaluation and assessment? Yes. Any of you part of any mid-states accreditations recently? Where they come to accredit your university and they look at your library and they're no longer asking how many volumes you have, they're asking what is your direct contribution to the academic success of the students, and you look at them and go, oh my God, how do I know? Well, if you don't, why are you there? But it's the idea of like, we have all these course management systems for distance education and we want the library to be there. What do we put? We put an access to the catalog in the database. We need to put access to a librarian who answered the question and can say, by the way, I answered this question of Jimmy. How did Jimmy do on the exam? Because that's how I can evaluate my assessment. We can no longer serve from the side. We can no longer serve from the side. There's an image of service in librarianship and it looks like this. Someone comes into our library. Sorry, I was standing backwards. Someone comes into our library and they ask us for stuff. And what we do is we assume that that stuff doesn't exist within the community, so we turn and point externally. Is your library an adjunct funnel sitting stuck onto the side of your institution? I mean, the professors are writing papers and the students are writing papers and they go to cite something, they don't have it, they go to the library, you buy it. What that means is eventually your library becomes an accumulation of everything that is not the institution. And when people realize they can get it directly and such, wait a minute, there's a problem. So we looked at institutional repositories. We said, oh, that's the solution. People will drop stuff in here. And what do the institutional repositories look like? Big bins of stuff. Big Dublin Core described bins of stuff that we can find things for, that are built for us to find things for, and make no sense to an academic. What should an institutional repository look like? I'm thinking Public Library of Science. What's the peer review? Where's the peer review? Where's the curation? Who's highlighting this? Who's the series editor on your staff for your institutional repository? How's this highlighting that text, that information? We must be active and participate in the improvement of our communities and larger society. We cannot. So we're talking about at Syracuse. We're talking about scholarly communication. We have a problem with scholarly communication, which is there's a lot of scholarly communication that totally bypasses the library. Imagine people are putting on speaker series and not telling us. People are writing blog posts and not getting them cataloged. I talked to one academic. He said, you know, I'm tenured. I write a paper. Maybe I get 100 people to read it if they get to my journal. I write a blog post. I get 10,000 people reading it. Where am I going to publish my latest ideas? Right? Where's the library in collecting and organizing that information? And so I was talking with librarians, and some of the librarians were saying, well, we've got to be ready for blog posts. We've got to be ready to take in blog posts. And I said, no! No! Don't be ready for anything, because if you leave it up to the academics, we are idiots. We are the worst people to handle scholarly communication are the scholars. We're horrific at it. Why? We're like us as archivists. Where's that paper you wrote in 1986? I don't know. Here's a 5 1/4 inch disc. And I think I wrote it in Scripsit. Go! Right? This idea that we know how to organize an institutional's knowledge? Forget it. The library needs to be walking up to me and saying, you need to correct that information and this is how we're going to do it. They need to leave, God forbid, the university committee in how we handle scholarly communication because they're the ones who do it. I was going through a tenure decision and I called up the library and said, you know, I need help doing a citation analysis, right? When I go for tenure, how many papers, how many cited, all that. You know what the library told me? Send you or your GA, and in 20 or 50 minutes, we can walk you through the resources you need to use. Excuse me, who in the world is better qualified to do bibliometric analysis of documents than the library? Imagine you get a list of every person going up for tenure that year. You show up at their door. I'm Dave. I'll be your librarian. I'll be doing your citation analysis. You live and die by my efforts. So the brownies can go here. The scotch can go here. Right? Now, the best part of this plan is if I don't get tenure, I leave and can't badmouth you, and if I get tenure, you're the best person in the whole world. Imagine that! If citation analysis is one of the vital ways in which we assess the academy, who is in a better stead to do that, and what more vital task is there than you doing that? Right? We cannot be silent on matters of ignorance. We cannot sit back and say they're doing it better. We must take advantage and work at it. Libraries are perfectly situated to succeed in this world. We function as authorities, not authoritarians. This idea that the web is full of crap and we only collect the good stuff, stop it. There is no good or bad stuff. It is all based on context and knowledge. That we are honest brokers and facilitators of conversations, that we are tool builders, that we need to stop riding waves and become the wave machine. Don't tweet because everyone does it. Figure out the replacement for Twitter that fits your needs. We provide the connective tissue in our organizations. What is the big theme on college campuses all over? Interdisciplinarity. And so, oh, Dave's an information scientist, and he's got to talk to economists. Well, guess what? You guys do that every day. You talk across those disciplines. Why aren't you, in essence, heading the effort of bringing these people together? Go, Dave, I know you were looking at this material. Maybe you should know this person's also looking at this material. Can't we get together? Ultimately, we have the ability, as an institution to create the great conversation. Libraries have a distributed network over 123,000 institutions in this country. School libraries, public libraries, academic libraries. Each one ingrained across as the connective tissue of their agencies and organizations. Imagine if we could network these conversations together. Millions of conversations sharing, relating, understanding, and creating infrastructure for the marketplace of ideas. Instead of us being paranoid and worried about sharing our collections of duplicative stuff. Instead of us obsessing about union catalogs of pre-existing materials, our collections are our community. If you're in an academic library, you know what your collection is? Your faculty, your students, your staff. Your collection, when you talk about managing your collection, collection development, what you should be thinking about is what do they know that I can capture, what can I provide to them, and maybe it's a book or a website or something else, but that's maintenance material to my true purpose, which is to maintain the collection of ideas in our organizations and our institutions. Ultimately, we have an obligation to lead. We must lead from core principles. We must not simply pick the next thing and try it. We don't want to get into the corn and pie business where we're simply trying the next thing because it's popular, but we must do it because we understand why it's happening. We must question tradition. We must wonder, why do we have institutions that exist like this forever? New York Times piece talking about the next industry that needs a major restructuring is higher education. That we need to totally restructure them after the auto industry. And guess what? I don't disagree, but I think that libraries should be part of the restructuring process. I'm not victims of it, not seeing how you can support it, leading it. You must become a mentor. You must guide the next generation. And ultimately, the true success of a mentor is when you create and work with someone that scares the hell out of you, that outperforms you and outpursues you. The best documentation of a mentor is when you eventually work for the people you are mentoring, right? Because you are the future of libraries. And how can a conservative, risk-averse, passive institution produce the revolutionary change that we need in society. That's what we need in society right now. We live in a time of great opportunity. Not a time of great wealth. Not a time of great resources. The most startling and amazing opportunities and innovations come from times just like this. Rahm Emanuel is credited for saying, a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. This is our time not to add more stuff, but to start taking away stuff from what we do. From looking at our collection budgets and saying, do we really need that much money to collect stuff, or should we be investing in more people to go out into the faculties? Instead of talking about buying the next great collection of philosophy works, maybe what we should be doing is funding a librarian to work with, directly with the philosophy department to accumulate their knowledge and get it out and improve their reputation. Now, it would be hilarious of me to assume that everyone buys into this argument. There are those among us who don't buy into this belief. So here's the annoying librarian. And the annoyed librarian is responding to a project we had, which was to produce a search engine based on reference, based on libraries. And libraries, they hire library school graduates. In case the penny hasn't dropped, let's do the comparison in our head. On the one hand, we have the best engineers and programmers in the country. They work at Google, by the way. This is from his, or hers, or its. And on the other hand, we have library school graduates. And I love this next line. Unless the ALA can lobby successfully for some anti-competitive labor standards favoring librarians, I don't see how librarians are going to compete. It gets worse. Libraries should just relax, because they're not going to reinvent anything. They never have. They never will. That's not what libraries are for. But a lot of librarians like to get all hot and bothered that they can't compete in a field they never should have entered in the first place. These are the people we need to expel. I think we should have the ability to revoke someone's Master's of Library Science. Because this idea that somehow we're not good enough, we're not powerful enough, we're not useful enough, that Google somehow is better than Google. How long has Google been in existence? 10 years? Do you think the people who started Google sat back and go, oh, God, well, Alta Vista's there. They don't need us. This idea that somehow that Google, like God came down and said, Google. That, no. Right? It's like saying, well, we never have to worry about pension plans because everyone knows once you get a job with General Motors, you're good for life. Things change. And here's the important thing. Things change. But they are changed by us. The best way to predict the future is to invent it. If we sit back, if we just sit passively back and assume that somehow someone else will take care of it, or it's not my problem, or that's not what librarians do, we have a problem. We are the passive deer in the headlights, then, and we will get hit. We need to be the people driving this thing. We need to look at our mission. To improve society, not simply to service society, to access society, to document society, to capture society, to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation. We don't deal with recorded knowledge here. I'm sorry, we're all out of that. We're just going to deal with knowledge. We just deal with people knowing. That we have the ability to do that within our communities. We live in times of great change and great opportunity, but only if we take advantage of them. If we sit back and allow other people to dictate our future, or to assume that somehow what's been going on for 100 years will either continue on for 100 years, or it's not my problem, then we are to blame. And it is worse than being lazy. It is unethical and immoral to sit back, see opportunity for improvement, and not act upon it. It is immoral. It is an ethical obligation of librarians to look at society and see how we can change and improve it. And we do that through service. We do that by understanding that our greatest success is the success of others. That is a noble goal. And I don't mean a good goal, a happy goal, a noble goal. That is Shakespearean in its scale to say that we can put aside our own ambitions to the point of others, but to understand that we must be equipped and resourced to do it. We do it through innovation. We do it not by doing the same thing we've always done, but by seeing the messiness and complexity and craziness of the world that we live in. When we look at a problem, our first reaction should not be to develop a policy for it. when we look at it, it should not be a form of task force or a committee or an initiative. When we look at it, it should be to solve the problem. This idea that librarians look to policy so they don't have to make decisions is irreprehensible. It is horrid. The idea that you are a professional is because you live in a world of ambiguity. You make the world of crazy ambiguity look simple to the outside world, but you must embrace the fact that we live in an interconnected, complex, crazy, messy, biased, crazy world, and you must revel in it. You must every day wake up and say, thank God the world is complex. Because without that complexity, what is my need for finding information? And we must ultimately do it through leadership. That we can't sit back and improve our own world and not assume that we must change the world of others. That we must be proactive. That we must be, in essence, missionaries. Walking forth with the passion and the drive of truth and knowledge. And bringing that light to those people who would rather choose ignorance. That is what we can do. That is the level of passion that we need within our profession. We need to see knowledge and learning and understanding and society not as a cold professorial action, but as an act of defiance and optimism for the future. We must become radical change agents that are never satisfied with society and the level of ignorance in it. We must work every day to bring the light to the world. And I invite you to join the mission and help me in that. Thank you very much. Questions? I get carried away sometimes. Yes, ma'am. This is one of the issues that I think I'm going to answer in terms of library science education, but let me, if I don't get it, hit me back. Which is, we need to stop worrying about preparing leaders. I think all too often in LIS education we talk about preparing leaders, which is the grand vision of the city on the hill and some technology skills and go get them. And needs to start instead preparing radical change agents, which are people who walk into any setting and instantly try and undermine the structure. And that means that we need to teach, and that means that people need to learn basic skills such as how do you identify the power structure, how you identify the innovation, what's the incentives going on, how do, you know, what are techniques from taking and giving people free pizza to embarrassing them in public. I mean, we really need to be somewhat mercenary in this. I think the short answer is, at a very simple step, if you can start whatever setting you're in having a simple, seemingly simple conversation as, what do we see our mission and what is the vision of our library in 15 years? Just say it that way. Because it sounds nice and academic and soft and safe, right? It's 15 years of that. And in that process, if you can be part of that process and pointing out to, well, why? Well, if we do this, how is that going to get us here? So step one is to get them worried. Putting the future sort of puts off the initial here, and it gives you a sort of platform to start talking about potential places for innovation. The other way is a technique we're working on called mapping conversations. But are you in an academic setting? Community college. If you said, so I worked with a small liberal arts college, and we said, who are the major audiences, people on campus? We have faculty, we have staff, we have administrators, we have students. All right, what conversations are going on in each of those? So, for example, at that time, the faculty and administration were locked in a conversation about the core. What is our core, liberal arts core, whatever. And so, all right, what's the conversation? Well, it goes to this committee and this. And they really mapped out how people were having that conversation. I said, all right, given all this, they then went to other sectors. What's the library do? What's the line between a library function and that conversation? And if there are lines that go to nowhere, why? And if there are lines that are going to parts of the conversation, ask, does that need to be reinforced? That's a very different way of doing planning from, what do you need from the library? Or, what does the library do well? We'll market the hell out of it. Right? It's an external view of which you service it. But also by doing that, particularly if you're the one who does it, you get a conversation with other power brokers on campus, and if they become your advocates internally, Right? So the faculty begin saying, you know, I was having a conversation and we really do need to log or wiki, or we really do need longer hours or something like this. That then becomes getting, particularly in an academic setting, the faculty on your side to show them direct input. Because you're right, changing within an institution can be very difficult. And ultimately, if you try your best, honest and in a way of integrity, to change the organization from within, I think you have two options. Get external change agents to come in, or you lead the organization. And no one likes to hear that last one, and I understand people have things like salaries and families. So that leaves you with one option, which is to get other people outside the organization on track to help push you. So. Lunch. All right, thank you. Wait, one more?
Well, how do you spread this message? You know, I'm thinking it's got a consortium of academic libraries in Central Connecticut, and we've probably got 45 librarians. None of them are here with me.
Yep.
Now, you know what you're doing here is kind of revitalizing an interest in why we became librarians.
Absolutely.
You know, I've been a librarian for 35, 36 years. And I remember when I was excited about the profession, and I remember when I was not.
Okay.
Right? And I go back and forth these days. But this is great. I mean, I applaud you.
Thanks.
So, how do you spread this message? How do you, where you speak of next?
Thank you. That's a wonderful transition. Because this URL at the bottom, you notice, is not the same one for where I'm going to put the slide, conversance.ning.com. But we're sort of putting on a virtual conversation right now, where we're posting, we have a keynote, we're trying to get people to present ideas. The problem with conferences, and I've got to be really careful because they're conference organizers, which is they're great and they're fabulous, but they're expensive and they're place and time-based. So the question is, how can we continue these conversations over time? And this is where the internet, I think, makes a huge amount of sense, right? Where, because increasingly, you know, I'm able to get violent on these things, and you can hear and see them. You don't just get a text write-up. That we can get together and find like-minded people as part of it. But the ultimate answer is, I can only do so many of these things. And so what I need is, if someone, I'm fortunate enough that people afterwards say, I buy it, I get it. And so what we need to do is figure out how to turn people who like that message into preachers of the message, as it were, into those missionaries. And so the question is, what are the tools that they need to do those? And I'm working my hardest to come up with them, but I'm only one person. So we need a whole group of people to stand up and do this. And so I'm very open to hearing, what do you need for those? You know, maybe it's me coming, but is it... for my wife's sake, is there something else? But, you know, what do we need to put in the hands of people to get them moving on this? We need tools, you know, the new holy books. We got prophets, we need the new holy books. We need, this conversation mapping system. Wouldn't it be great if we could literally do it online so you could fill it in and have it and make it into something sort of libqual-like, not in its level of effort, but in its sort of universal understanding of it. So I have some ideas, but I'm really open to hearing other people's ideas. Here's a great place to start sharing them, and I need a better answer to that question in general. So, now lunch. Thank you.